After the strangeness of that first day, we quickly find our rhythm. I learn to work unselfconsciously. Paul, for the most part, observes in silence. Often, in fact, he leaves me to my own devices as he walks around the office making notes in his pad, occasionally taking pictures with his phone. Whatever fears I had that I would be required to perform or emote or any of the things I came here to avoid are quickly banished. He is at pains not to intrude on me any more than he has to. Unfortunately, not everyone is respectful of the artistic process.
I have begun reading your book,
Jürgen says, adding, in case there is any confusion, for love of a clown. Aha, Paul says.
I'm loving the character of Stacy. She's based on somebody you know?
No, I made her up.
Her little nephew, Timmy, he is driving her crazy, Jürgen laughs. Always he's getting into mischief. Stacy will be glad when her sister comes back from her research trip.
Yeah, Paul says.
I wonder if she will commit to her promise to bring Timmy to the circus,
Jürgen says, frowning.
Always she's making excuses.
Obviously she's going to bring him to the circus, I say scathingly when Paul is out of earshot. How else are they going to meet the clown?
That is a good point, Jürgen concedes.
If they didn't go to the circus, there would be no book. It would end on page 15.
Yes,
Jürgen says, flicking through his copy as though to ascertain that it does in fact have words right up to the last page. Ish is even worse. She gives Paul constant updates on her progress through the novel. Sometimes I hear her reading chunks of it back to him. On other occasions, she will relate anecdotes from her life before the bank, cornering him in order to show him the innumerable pictures of her travels with Tog, her awful ex-fiancé. With me, he speaks almost exclusively of the bank and its doings, the fees we charge, how much one of my research notes might sell for, the minimum assets a client must have in order to be taken on by BOT, and so on. He says he wants to understand my work completely before looking at any other aspects of my life. This suits me perfectly well. When you work for 100 hours a week, there are few other aspects to see. Even at the weekend, you remain on call. There might be a golf game with a customer, or a VP will dump a client on you at the last minute, needing analysis on a potential buyer for a Sunday board meeting. Occasionally, I get a call from someone I know at La Défense, visiting on business or posted here with one of the big French banks. I will go to a bar with them and listen to them complain about how bad the food is, how hard it is to sleep with Irish girls. I will find myself seeing them through my father's eyes, their slick hair, their pointed shoes, and wonder if this is what he saw when he looked at me. But in general, investment banking is not an industry that fosters close relationships. Friendship exists here in a purely contingent way, on the basis of a mutual coincidence of wants. Even to people you like, it's best not to reveal anything that might be used against you.
It sounds so cynical, Paul says.
As long as everyone understands those are the rules, it does not cause any issues.
And even a Vish, you'd say this?
I'd say it's something she needs to learn. Paul watches me with a kind of veiled amusement, rocking gently in his chair.
So what's the point of it?
He asks. The point?
Why put yourself through all this? Why starve yourself of a life just to make money? Is that it?
Howie says that if you have to ask why, then you are in the wrong game.
But what do you say?
He waits, his notebook in his lap. It is dusk. Fluorescent lights stud the darkening sky outside like imitation jewels. You're right, I say. It's just to make money. I wonder what he's like, he says. You know, what his life is like. I don't reply. A couple of heavyweight Spanish banks, rumored to be facing significant write-downs on non-performing property loans, are being aggressively targeted by speculators. The effect is rippling outward to affect the entire sector, unraveling Europe's latest bid to stabilize itself. I bet he lives in a huge mansion, he says, with a pool and Bentley. And in his garden, he's got those, you know, those bushes where they shape them into animals?
Topiary?
Topiary, Ish repeats dreamily, as if pronouncing the name of some mythical land. What do you think, Claude? Has he said anything to you? No, I say in a bored voice, but the truth is that I too yearn to learn more about Paul's life. He gets to work at 8, he leaves around 6. Beyond that, I know almost nothing.
Do you think Billy Budd knew where Melville lived?
He'll say if I press him.
Do you think Emma Bovary knew what Flaubert did all day?
I suppose not, I concede.
I want you to act as if I'm not there. The less you know about my life, the easier that'll be.
Have you got to the part yet where the clown brings Stacy and Timmy backstage at the circus?
Ish says now.
No, I say.
It's so beautiful, she says. She sits smacking her gum for another minute, then she gets up. I think I'll go and ask him how he thought of that scene.
I wish you would stop distracting him.
Who says I'm distracting him?
He's trying to work on his project and you have a report to finish? Ish tiptoes around behind me, then crouches down and whispers into my ear.
I think the real problem is that someone's jealous.
I don't know what you mean.
You're jealous, she exclaims, straightening up. Who's jealous?
Jürgen says, passing by.
Claude's jealous of me talking to his boyfriend, Ish says.
Paul is not my boyfriend, I say.
Look what I have, Jürgen says, and takes from his briefcase a hardback copy of For Love of a Clown.
A first edition, and it's signed.
I open it to the title page where Paul has crossed out his name and written For Jürgen, with Irie, Paul. I look up at him blankly. Irie?
It is a reggae reference, Jürgen says. I have been telling Paul about my old reggae band.
I didn't know you had a band, he says. Jürgen nods.
Back in Munich, Gerhard and the Majors. Mostly German language covers, but we had original numbers too. We were regarded as being one of the best reggae and rock steady crews on the Bavarian financial scene.
Were you the singer? Ish asks.
No, that was Gerhard. He was at the time the number one risk analyst at Morgan Stanley. Our rhythm section came from the Credit Suisse syndicated lending department. Then there was me on guitar and mortgage-backed securities.
Their conversation fades out. I remain entranced by this inscribed page. I have never seen Paul's handwriting before. It is sprawling, straggly like briars over a tombstone. Unprompted, an image appears in my head. The author at a cherrywood table. His hand moving across the page, depicting the minutiae of our lives in thickets of ink. For the first time it strikes me. We are being narrated.
Ish snaps her fingers. Let's bring Paul to life tonight. That way we can find out more about him and give him a chance to see our crazy side.
I groan and rub my eyes. There is work to do, I say. Am I the only person who cares about work?
That is a great idea, Jürgen says. Do you think he'll come?
Of course he'll come, Ish says. Bending one foot up to her knee, she begins to hop around, arms up, stretched to the ceiling tiles and the fluorescent lighting.
Sorry, Claude, she declaims, but no one person can own Paul. He belongs to everyone. I will go and ask him now, Jürgen says, and he walks away, singing to himself, Mach dir keine Sorgen über die Dinge.
Like the air. Ish hops back towards her desk, like birdsong, like sunshine. To my surprise, Paul accepts the invitation. Now the issue becomes making it out of the office. It has been another bad day. A very, very bad day for Ireland on the markets. The two ailing Spanish banks have caused a panic across the whole continent, with investors scrambling to pull their funds out of any bank felt to be vulnerable, which includes all the major Irish institutions. The worst hit, Royal Irish, lost $1 million for almost every minute of trading. And every time I put on my coat, another frantic client calls wanting to know if the government will step in to save it. But the minister has yet to make a statement. In fact, no one seems to know where the minister even is. Just after 6 o'clock, I am summoned upstairs by the chief operating officer. Exiting the lift on the 7th floor, I walk straight into an enormous garda. My mind floods with a whole new order of panic. Have we been robbed? Is the building under siege? The secretary appears in the doorway and motions me impatiently into the corner office.
Ah, Claude, there you are.
Whatever turn of events has brought a policeman into her foyer doesn't seem to have bothered Rachel. But then, Rachel is imperturbable. No matter the time or day or state of the market, she always looks immaculate, streamlined, frictionless, like a virtual avatar of herself. Her hair is perfectly blonde, her skin perfectly white. Her very presence has been buffed to a sheen as smooth as a mirror. People say she has slept her way to the top, but it is literally impossible to imagine her having sex with Sir Colin or anyone else. Others like to say she has a USB port instead of a vagina, and that her husband uses her to charge his phone, which seems marginally more plausible. 4 men are in her office, crowded uncomfortably on couch and chairs with cups and saucers balanced on their knees.
Gentlemen, Rachel says, allow me to introduce Claude Matignal, one of our most talented analysts.
I turn to the seated men and experience one of those cognitive shocks specific to meeting in real life someone long familiar from a screen. For the last 2 years, ever since the collapse of Lehman Brothers finally ignited the bonfire that was the Irish economy, the Minister for Finance has appeared almost nightly on TV news, where he has always seemed measured, controlled on top of the situation. In the couple of seconds it takes him to half rise and greet me, it is frighteningly clear that this confidence is a veneer no thicker than the film of makeup applied backstage. Up close, unmediated, he seems actually to embody the country's dire condition. Shadows devour his features. Beads of moisture cling morbidly to the grey folds of his skin. His courtly, reasonable bearing is belied by great dark rings around his eyes. I had heard he was unwell. When I lean in to shake his hand, I am hit by a stench so deathly I have to fight the instinct to recoil. Rachel introduces the 2 men on either side of him as the Secretary General of the Department of Finance and the second secretary at the department in charge of banking policy. One is fat, one is thin. Both wear glasses and the pursed dismissive means of civil service lifers. Nearest the door is a 4th man, small with lugubrious eyes and a sallow complexion reminiscent of yellowing pages. He does not look Irish, but continental, Portuguese maybe, or Corsican. Rachel does not tell me his name, and he does not introduce himself. In fact, he does not speak at all during the meeting, just remains in his corner, semi-translucent, staring at the minister with those dolorous, unblinking eyes. Rachel closes the door and turns to me brightly. The minister has dropped by to speak to us. Informally, the fat secretary interjects. To speak to us informally about the current uncertainty in the Irish banking sector. Rachel cannot hide her delight at this coup. She is positively glowing. Minister, Claude has advised several major international investors in relation to Irish banks. The minister opens his mouth into a strange, gaping smile and wags it at me, like a grandfather who has had a stroke and is incapable of speaking. Then, as if this effort has caused some internal upset, he hastily brings a handkerchief to his mouth.
Claude, perhaps you could explain a little more of what it is you do?
Rachel prompts me.
Certainly, I reply, and begin to paint a broad picture of my role, namely to dig through the loan books, deposit books, and then exploded assets of distressed or defunct Irish banks, looking for anything ignored or undervalued that an external capital provider might take an interest in.
Picking off the good stuff for the vultures? The thin secretary translates. I smile courteously. Even the vultures have to be persuaded to invest in Ireland at the moment. He sniffs. It is the fatter secretary who speaks next.
Obviously the reason we're here is Royal Irish, he says. We've sunk a lot of money into it, quite apart from the guarantee, and at this stage we thought things would be turning around.
They were turning around,
the thin man corrects him. Up until a couple of days ago. But now, because of these bloody Spanish, we've got investors pulling their money out again, and it's starting to look like it'll be another recapitalization.
Obviously, there are very good reasons for keeping the bank open,
the fat man says, slinging a foot across his knee.
It's of systemic importance, obviously, and we want to send the message to our international friends that Ireland's financial sector is in perfect health and ready to do business. At the same time, we can't just keep paying and paying.
So, I suppose what we want, the thin man says airily, is to get a fresh perspective on the situation vis-a-vis Royal Irish. Our advisors tell us core capital ratios have been returning to acceptable levels, but that once it gets over this, as it were, hump, it should be able to return to profitability without further government assistance. We'd like to know, beyond the current situation, where you might see the bank's position in 6 months, a year.
The minister grins mechanically and works his jaws by way of endorsing this, a blast of fetid air issuing as he does so. All eyes are now on me, but I am not sure how to proceed. Things have not been turning around at Royal Irish. Royal Irish has been hemorrhaging money for months. First investors' money, then taxpayers' money. The general rule in banking is to tell the client what he wants to hear. That way, if you're wrong, he's less likely to hold you to blame. But to claim that Royal Irish can keep going for another week, let alone 6 months, would be like saying Louis XVI is alive and well and will shortly be resuming his kingly duties. It is finished as a going concern. Surely they know that. The men are waiting. I glance over to Rachel. She draws a thoughtful breath, a weirdly synthetic gesture, like a doll opening and shutting its sightless eyes. Maybe you could give us a broad idea of what a return to profitability might look like, she says with a meaningful nod. I think for a moment, then start talking in vague terms about the volatility of the market, how nobody knows what will happen, how some Irish brands are certainly undervalued. It all depends, I say, on the wider recovery in Europe. If things stabilize, and if Royal genuinely do have capital reserves, and if they pursue a particular strategy and divest themselves of their toxic assets, then yes, in that scenario, they could get back on their feet. Each of those ifs would require a miracle, but the secretaries seem pleased with what they hear. They ask some follow-up questions using financial jargon that makes no sense. The minister, meanwhile, gazes down at his lap. He appears to be picking skin from his fingers. It comes away in loose white skeins, which flutter down to the floor. Then he leans over to the thin secretary and gurgles something in his ear. Yes, the secretary says and turns to Rachel. There's a new man in charge here? This fellow Blankley? Porter Blankley, that's correct. He's based in New York, of course. She addresses this to the minister, who is gazing up at her with a kind of prayerful desperation. But I speak to him almost every day. Porter is, well, I'm sure I don't need to tell you, he's an inspirational figure. He believes that if you can get the market on your side, anything is possible. The secretaries seem pleased with this too. They whisper together for a moment. The minister grins at us, a crunching sound issuing from his mouth along with a fresh gust of fetor. He is eating raw garlic, I realized. He has been peeling skin from a clove he clutches in his left hand. Thank you, Claude, Rachel says. Taking my cue, I stand up and shake hands with the visitors again. The minister has his handkerchief pressed to his mouth again. Above it, his shell-blue eyes roll wetly at me as if signaling desperately, there is a man trapped in here. I don't get it. What did he want you to do? It's Friday night. We are leaving the building at last. Reassure him. Make him feel he has made the right decision to recapitalize Royal Irish. Tell him they can still get back on their feet. And they can't. At this stage, Royal Irish doesn't even have feet. Just an asshole, Ish grumbles. You mean Miles? Paul says. If any one person can be held responsible for Ireland's current state, it is Royal Irish CEO Miles O'Connor, who made some 40 billion euros of loans to property developers that then went bust, although next on the list would be the minister himself, who has committed the country to paying off all the money that Royal and the other banks owe.
It's hard to understand. In France, where if someone misses a coffee break, there is a national strike, a scandal like this would have shut down the streets. Yet the Irish seem able to absorb any amount of punishment without complaint. Like the drunk at the bar you expect any moment to topple off his stool, who instead keeps throwing back shots, his massive inebriation having become a kind of self-perpetuating system, a kind of replacement gravity. Just as I am thinking this, I hear Ish say with a note of alarm,
"Whoa, that guy looks a bit the worse for wear."
That's putting it mildly. The gentleman in question, wearing a dark wool suit, has a bloody red socket where his left eye ought to be, and a withered claw instead of a hand. We stop and watch as he lurches over the plaza and across the bridge, where he is greeted by 5 or 6 other similarly cadaverous figures.
"Zombies,"
Jürgen says. The zombies have raised a tent on the riverbank opposite, around which they stagger, gesticulating at the traffic with authentically decomposing hands.
"What's this about?"
Paul says. "That building there was supposed to be the Royal Irish's new headquarters," I tell him, pointing to the concrete shell on the far side of the river. "They had just started construction when the crisis hit."
"Why the costumes, though?"
A zombie is what you call a bank that's still trading, even though it's insolvent. The first revenant has produced a placard that reads, "Do not feed the zombies," and is waving it about. They're saying that if a bank is finished, the government shouldn't be giving it any more taxpayer money.
"But why would they give it more money?"
Paul asks.
"If it's dead in the water?"
They're in denial. They still think it can be saved. Paul says as one of the zombies' arms falls off and under the wheels of a truck. The financial services center brings in a lot of money, Ish says, but the reason it does is that all of these international banks and funds and special purpose vehicles and God knows what else can come here and do whatever it is they want to do. And they know they'll be left alone. It's a bit like a red light zone, see?
So,
Paul is not quite making the connection. So if a bank goes bust, it's like if a hooker dropped dead. Suddenly there's ambulances coming in, health authorities wanting to do blood tests, news crews demanding to know what's happened. Even if you, Mr. Sex Tourist, aren't worried about catching whatever it is killed her, still, it's not feeling so private anymore. So you quickly pack your bag, and the next day you're off to Luxembourg or Liechtenstein or the British Virgin Islands or wherever it might be.
You mean the Irish government want to cover it up because it's bad for business?
Who knows? Maybe they genuinely think Royal Irish is salvageable. Stick a few more billion in there, close your eyes, and hope for the best. It is what in the bank we call magical thinking, I add. It is more prevalent than you might expect. Paul gazes at the cavorting zombies, the great financial memento mori that is the unbuilt bank hanging over the Grey River.
"They're gonna need it," he says.
And here is life. Dark and full of strangers yelling at each other from their private intoxications like monkeys screeching through the bars of their cage. Music booms all around, prohibiting conversation at anything less than a shout. Battalions of drones, haircuts modelled after the heroes of the day, neck their fizzy lagers, their syrupy alcopops, and perform the minimal courting rituals required before they have sex with each other. The bar's style is classic Celtic tiger. White armchairs with zebra throws, ubiquitous mirrors, large unseated area, palpable air of incipient violence, like a cross between a hairdresser's and the Stanford prison experiment. Nevertheless, life is the closest thing the Financial Services Center has to a local. This is where the real information is exchanged. Who's getting paid what, who's hiring, who's on the way up, down, out, tips for good schools, good builders, good mechanics, good tailors, good divorce lawyers. The name is a pun. Life is Gaelic for Liffey, the river that splits the city into north and south, and broadly rich and poor, and gives rise to many more puns. I hate life, after a few drinks life won't seem so bad, and so on, which we make instead of finding somewhere less repugnant. On Friday nights, patrons will typically skip dinner in order to start drinking sooner, unthinkable in Paris. Get stuck beside Ish and you will first be treated to what seems an unending series of humorous cat videos. Then, as the hysterical laughter dies away, find yourself attempting fruitlessly to comfort her as she rehearses yet again the breakup of her relationship, before lurching off into the night with whichever opportunist has bought her last drink. Tonight the turbulence on the markets has lent an extra edge of mania to the proceedings, as employees of the many banks, not currently punching above their weights, contemplate the idea that this time next week they may be out of a job and reach desperately for a life belt.
Think the brunette there's taking a shine to you, Kev?
Gary McCrum, utilities analyst, says. Kevin turns to look. The dark-haired girl at the end of the adjoining table glances up and away again. She has delicate hands, eyes with a little too much white in them, a disorienting air of weightlessness, like a dress on a clothesline flapping in the wind.
Totally checking you out,
Dave Davison, commodities, confirms. Kevin scrutinizes the brunette dubiously, like a diner in a restaurant examining the lobsters in the tank.
Is she hot?
Is she hot?
She's right there in front of you. I've looked at so much porn I can't tell anymore if IRL women are good-looking or not,
Kevin confesses.
I have to imagine if I saw her on a screen, would I click on her?
IRL? I ask David Davison. This means Ireland? Irish women?
In real life, Grandad. Here, Kev, look at her through my phone. See, she's an 8. Easy.
Well, a 7, Gary says.
Maybe she is more of a 7,
Dave concedes.
I'm not wasting a drink on a 7,
Kevin says and turns his back on the brunette, who dips her eyes woundedly into her lap, then reaffixes herself to her friend's conversation, throwing her toothy smile about the room betimes like a cracked whip.
I used to feel that way about 7s,
Dave says sadly. Then I got married.
Those two are really hitting it off,
Jürgen says to me, nodding over to where for the last half an hour Paul and Ish have been deep in conversation. I hope she's not telling him anything too personal, I say.
Such as her theories about where it all went wrong with Torg,
Jürgen says. Yes.
All the time she got diarrhea in China.
My eyes widen. You think she's telling him the Yangtze River boat story? Maybe I should go and check, I decide, but someone is blocking my path. It's Howie, arriving with Tom Kremins, Brian O'Brien, and a couple of other traders, all carrying glasses of single malt whiskey. They crowd in beside us. The girls at the next table swivel their heads towards us once more like lovely monotropic flowers.
Here you had a little chat with the government today,
Howie says to me.
What do they tell you? Are they going to recap Royal?
He didn't say.
He must have said something.
He actually didn't,
I say, recalling with a twinge of horror the minister's grinning, terrorized aphasia.
Anyway, even if I knew, I couldn't tell you. You know I couldn't tell you,
raising my voice as he starts swearing at me.
It'd be insider trading. Crazy frog, if they locked up everyone in this town who's insider trading, there'd be no one left on the fucking inside.
Howie plonks his glass down on the table, making the ice cubes jingle.
Someone ought to be making money out of the Eurozone shit show. This whole fucking week has been a disaster on every conceivable level. I've been raped by a guy with a tiny cock.
The eavesdropping girls flinch, but don't stop staring. Howie's attention, however, is already elsewhere.
Is that the writer?
Pushing past me, he taps on Paul's shoulder and asks him the same question. Paul turns with a slightly confused smile.
What the fuck are you doing writing a book about this guy?
Howie demands, gesturing at me.
Huh?
Paul says, looking startled.
He's not a player. He's a research analyst. It's like you've gone to Silverstone and you're watching the mechanics. I mean, do what you want.
Howie sniffs.
It just sounds like a boring book, that's all.
Well, you see, in a way, that's the...
There is crazy shit going down right now.
Howie interrupts.
I mean world historical craziness. You should be speaking to the traders or the hedge funds. If I had a hedge fund, I'd be shorting the shit out of the whole of Europe. And in 6 months, I'd be a billionaire.
You're talking about the...
The whole continent's fucked. The politicians don't know what to do. All that can save it now is a war.
War?
Kevin hiccups.
That's the way it's heading. France, Italy, Spain are all watching their economies go down the tube. Germany's there with its arms folded saying, don't expect anything from us. There's all the ingredients for a war, right? And it would stop all the, you know, the bollocks.
War. Paul repeats, scribbling in his red notebook.
War is a good thing. What stopped the Great Depression, World War II? Or look at the Baghdad bounce. Nasdaq crashes, the economy's asshole, till the US invades Iraq and the stock markets go up 80%. Capitalism needs war. Besides, war is what made Europe great. The whole reason the currency's in the toilet is you've got a bunch of bureaucrats in charge trying to pretend the last 1,000 years of history never happened, acting like Europe's all just one big happy family singing and holding hands like a bunch of fucking Smurfs. And they wonder why everyone's lining up to short them. Would you invest in a Smurf economy?
I wouldn't,
Kevin says.
No way! Howie says, but his eyes are suddenly vacant and he peers back and forth as if he can't remember what he's doing here.
At that moment, Tom Crimmins pulls his sleeve. We're going, he says.
Yeah,
Howie says and drains his glass. He turns to Paul once more.
When you get tired of talking to this joker, come and see me, he says. I'll show you stuff that'll have you hemorrhaging from every orifice.
With that, he and the traders bounce off, their conversation a blizzard of acronyms and stomach-turning sexual references, like a Scrabble game at a gangbang.
Interesting guy, Paul says thoughtfully.
I watch him watch Howie barge his way through the drunken, suited bodies, feeling the same pang I might have at a school dance, seeing the girl I adored bloom at the attentions of some handsome delinquent. Then, as if he senses my unhappiness, Paul turns to me and with an enthusiasm that strikes me as false, says,
Well then, you're all interesting. I just had a great conversation with your friend here. Did you know she studied anthropology? I thought you bankers were all rocket scientists.
That's just the traders, I say. My background is philosophy. François Texier, do you know him?
Paul shakes his head.
In fact, he might be a useful person to think about for your book, I say. He had many fascinating ideas about simulacra and the derealization of modern life.
Derealization?
Paul repeats with a half-smile.
Yes, he was interested in a Buddhist concept called sunyata or voidness. According to this sunyata, reality as we perceive it is an illusion. We see the world as divided up into objects, this glass, this table, this person, but in fact, these are merely snapshots of processes that are in a constant state of change, all parts of a great intermingling flux.
That does sound pretty derealizing, Paul admits.
Actually, the derealizing comes as an attempt to cover over this notion of flux, I say, excited to feel these thoughts coming to life in my mind again. To a culture centered on the individual, the idea that we are all just transitory surface effects of some great sea of emptiness has not been popular. Texier's argument is that most of Western civilization has been an attempt to build over the void with huge static systems of thought, religious, economic, scientific, that divide everything into facts, each with its own specific place. We call it analysis, but really it is escape. Or as he puts it, we write the encyclopedia to explain the world, and then we leave the world to live in the encyclopedia. The simulacrum is a kind of derivative of his...
Oi, what's going on here? Ish arrives with a tray of drinks.
You know the rules, Claude. Friday night, no Frenchness.
I'm just explaining that we have all come to banking from different disciplines, I say.
Kevin here was halfway through a medical degree, Ish says. Imagine, he could actually have been useful to somebody. Doctors don't make shit these days.
Kevin says.
It used to be the smartest people didn't always want to be the richest people, Paul says.
Maybe the smartest people got smarter,
Kevin returns. I'm not going to spend the rest of my life in it, Ish says.
I've still got a box of my old clothes at home. As soon as I get my next bonus, I'm going to chuck my whole wardrobe of daggy work shit right into a skip and fuck off to the Pacific. It'll be like corporate-ish never existed.
What about your apartment, I say.
Oh, yeah.
Her face falls. Turning to Kevin, she says,
Here, want to buy an apartment? It's got a B-day. Property's finished,
Kevin says.
I'm putting all my money into global pandemics.
As midnight approaches, I see Paul put on his coat. The end of your first week, I say. It is all going well?
Sure, he says, but I detect a hesitation. Only, that's nothing. He reassures me. I'm just trying to figure out how it all hangs together.
If you have questions, maybe I can help. At first he blusters nothings, then he pauses, looks at me, as if deciding whether to take me into his confidence.
I feel like I'm missing something,
he says.
I've got the characters, what you do, the rhythm of the day, but I feel like I'm not getting to the heart of things, you know?
I must look very worried because he claps me on the shoulder.
It'll come. Maybe I just need to change my focus a little bit.
Will we see you on Monday? I say.
Of course. He grins. Have a good weekend. You're off camera, let your hair down.
Not long after, the lights come up. Life begins to empty. Its pinchbeck promises having slipped away, as always, through the cracks of the night. We gather our things and make our way outside. I am deep in thought. What Paul said about missing something bothers me, and as if picking up on that, Jürgen says,
So has he told you what's going to happen?
Happen?
In the book.
We know what is going to happen in the book, I say. It is about me, a modern everyman, experiencing a typical day.
Yes, but there will be some kind of story also.
That is the story, I say.
That is the story?
Yes.
You sitting at your computer writing research notes about banks?
That's right. Jürgen says nothing to this. It's not supposed to be one of those books where things happen, I explain. It's about discovering the humanity in ordinary lives.
Oh,
Jürgen says. There is another silence. It's not going to be boring, I say.
Of course not,
he says. Around us, the center looms, darkened and empty like a perspex necropolis. I think again of Paul's parting words, and anxiety quickens in my sinews once more. Did he say anything to you? I turn to Ish. What were you talking to him about for so long? He was asking me about the Toribundo Archipelago. I travelled around there for a bit with Tog back in the day. She pauses, then says, I reckon he's got something planned for you.
Like what?
Like, I don't know. Maybe you fall in love. I'm not going to fall in love, I say categorically.
In a book, this is exactly the kind of thing the main character will say right before he falls in love.
Jürgen says,
Yeah, says Ish. Plus you're French. You lot practically invented love. French kissing, French letters. It's the whole French thing.
How would you feel if I said the whole Australian thing was kangaroos and tinnies and daytime soap operas?
That is the whole Australian thing, Claude. Why do you think I left?
Yes, well, then you will understand that not everyone fits into the national stereotype.
I certainly do not think that when people speak of the typical German,
Jürgen chuckles,
they are imagining a crazy man who loves reggae music and writes articles about medieval economics while listening to reggae music on his computer.
My point is that adventures, escapades, dramatic reversals, falling in love, these are the hackneyed tropes that Paul's trying to get away from. I tell Ish, though I am perhaps trying to persuade myself as much as her. He wants to depict modernity as it genuinely is. Love's not hackneyed, Ish says obstinately. What does love have to do with this place? I throw my arms up at the surroundings, great glass panopticons surveying all the other panopticons. I am serious. What does love have to do with anything we do all day long?
Well, that's what he'd better work out, Ish says, if he wants anyone to read his book.
There are plenty of good stories without love.
Like what?
I think for a moment. 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea? We have emerged onto the quay. Over the river, beneath the concrete skull of the unfinished headquarters, the zombies sleep in silence.
Just because you don't have it doesn't mean you don't need it, Ish says, staring into the dark water. Every story needs love, even at the bottom of the sea.
Over the weekend, Forbes published a long article about our new chief executive, Porter Blankley. The accompanying photographs show a man in his 60s with the craggy, portentous good looks of the star of a Hollywood Bible epic, and white hair in a sculpted wave like a roll of ice cream caught mid-scoop. In every picture he is shaking hands with someone as if that's all he does for a living. Anyone in the industry will know that each of those handshakes represents a game-changing new synergy, a market stampede, and a multi-million-dollar windfall for his shareholders. The piece is titled Blank to the Future, and it runs as follows. 4 years ago this summer, Porter Blankley achieved a dream he had cherished since childhood. He became a billionaire. Subprime mortgages were booming, and Danforth Blauer, a bank once perceived as a starchy also ran, was, thanks to his leadership, right at the heart of the action. The day's stock options took his wealth on paper to the magical 10 figures. Blankley celebrated with a quiet dinner at home with his wife and legal team. Then he bought 8 stories of the Empire State Building. Porter Blankley has always dreamed big. Hailing from a hard-scrabble town of blue-collar laborers, many of them employed on his father's private railroad, he was spotted as a teenager by a scout for Harvard's varsity golf team. He dropped out of Old Crimson after only a year to play full-time, and although a shoulder injury cut short his professional career, his experiences on the courses of the 1960s were formative. This was a time of ferment in the Massachusetts golf scene. Ideas and books by the young firebrands of the new conservative movement were being passed around, as well as other material. U.S. Ryder Cup team captain Don Hartford turned up one day with a sheet of blotter acid, Blankley recalled later, and everything changed. The fairways were rainbows, the holes were mouths speaking to you. You've heard about crazy golf, and that time all golf was crazy. People were showing up in sunglasses, without ties, everything was being questioned. The potent cocktail of fiscal conservatism and perception-altering drugs would shape an entire generation. Many of the figures Blankley encountered at that time went on to become key figures in politics, banking, and in the nascent world of computing, into which they carried the revolutionary concept they had learned on the fairways, that reality was plastic and could be molded as they saw fit. Though he never completed his degree and had no training in finance, arriving in Wall Street, Blankley found his +2 handicap much in demand. He was taken under the wing of the legendary Walter Wriston of Citibank, and as he quickly came to dominate in interbank and pro-am tournaments, effectively given an open brief. At the time, the major banks were plowing money into Latin American dictatorships, but Blankley, never one to follow the crowd, instead staked his money on a then little-known warlord in the Middle East. The bet paid off. While Wall Street lost a fortune when their dictators were deposed, Ahmed bin Ahmed, as he was then known, went on to become the caliph of the oil-rich state of Oran, and today remains one of Blankley's biggest financial backers and closest personal friends. Tragedy was to strike at the end of the 1970s, when his wife of only 6 months, heiress Cressida Heinz Boeing, committed suicide, but Blankley bounced back, taking a position at Drexel Burnham as the junk bond boom began. This was the age of the so-called masters of the universe, when traders made millions from peddling mountains of practically worthless bonds. Blankley soon became famous for his aggressive acquisition strategy and his colorful private life, dating a string of models and being photographed in New York's hottest night spots. Yet behind the scenes, he was under considerable pressure. The collapse of the junk bond market following the indictment of his boss and close personal friend Michael Milken left him with personal losses of over $10 million. A greater loss was soon to follow with the suicide of his second wife, Caspian Dupont. Reeling from this double blow, Blankley spent some time in the financial wilderness. According to friends, he thought seriously about leaving banking and beginning a new career,
possibly in restoring old boats. However, the dearth of professional-level golfers in the major houses soon had Wall Street beating a path to his door. He returned to City in the early 1990s, where he remained a divisive figure, beloved among employees for his inspirational memos, but attracting controversy for his refusal to indulge what he called the mania of that time for political correctness. He drew fire for remarking to a reporter that, with regard to Wall Street management structure, women on top was his least favorite position. Less than a week later, he found himself in hot water again after accusing African-American golfer Tiger Woods of stealing his wallet at a fundraising event. This was a challenging time for Blankley, one which in later years he would refer to as the toughest hole. His venture capital firm, Tourniquet, which had invested over $1 billion in websites aimed directly at dogs, cats and other pets, was wiped out by the internet crash, while on the home front his third wife, Fanfarla Pinochet, survived only by a miracle after accidentally dropping a toaster into her bath. The couple divorced later that year. But he was to bounce back with the September 11 attacks on the World Trade Center. Now with hedge fund Elite Capital Partnership, Blankley is widely believed to have put in a huge order for gold in the seconds after the first plane hit. By the time the second tower fell 2 hours later, the price of gold had already risen almost 20%. In the chaos that followed, this single transaction is believed to have resulted in almost unthinkable profits for a small number of investors, including Blankley's longtime friend, the Caliph of Oran. Although no records of the trade exist, Blankley was very soon headhunted by Danforth Blauer, where he became the most highly remunerated CEO in the world. Within a year, he was delivering record profits through heavy investment in subprime mortgages. He featured on the cover of Fortune, and in the accompanying interview told the reporter that we are in a new paradigm of growth now that cannot be stopped. This paradigm did stop shortly afterwards, however, and with the collapse of the subprime housing market, the subsequent credit crunch, and worldwide losses of trillions of dollars, Danforth Blauer was saved from annihilation only by a last-second government bailout. Public anger towards industry chiefs like Blankley, who throughout his career had criticized politicians for any attempt to regulate Wall Street's activities, was exacerbated by the discovery that Danforth had in fact been betting heavily against the toxic subprime assets they sold their clients. It then emerged that billions of dollars of taxpayers' money handed over to rescue the firm had been used not only to pay huge bonuses to the failed bank's executives, but also for a Hawaiian-themed rescue party, which featured a live performance from rapper Fugly B of his 2008 hit Bag It and Split, Fuck You Bitches, as well as a swimming pool filled with banknotes. Worse, not long after the bailout, a life-size bronze statue of himself that Blankley was having delivered by crane to his office was dropped onto a bus of special needs students visiting Wall Street for the day. While none was injured, Blankley's job was felt to be untenable and he stepped down, with a further leaving bonus of $33 million and a replacement bond statue. Though Blankley had been pilloried for some for turning reality into a fruit machine via complex financial instruments of which he himself had little understanding, the leak of his highly embarrassing memo re-hootsits and whatsits for collateralized debt obligations and synthetic collateralized debt obligations respectively, others took a more nuanced view. Following his departure from Danforth, Blankley, still a scratch golfer with famously soft hands, was approached with several different job offers, including special advisor to the Treasury, chair of professional ethics at Harvard University, and president of the World Bank. It is no surprise, however, that the man who once said he had capital allocation in his blood opted in the end to return to investment banking. Previously helmed by Sir Colin Shred, best known for his outspoken views on the Windsor Knot, Bank of Torabundo emerged from the crisis punching above its weight and hungry for fresh ideas on loan portfolio management. A statement to shareholders said that Blankley's brief was to radicalize the bank's MO and leverage its sound financial fundamentals into market share.
Potential joint ventures or other strategic combinations have not been ruled out, though Blankley has refused to comment on rumors that the bank will begin trading on its own account, or that he is seeking to set up a hedge fund within the firm itself. About his own role in the financial collapse, which in the US alone has cost more than the New Deal, the Marshall Plan, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, the 1980s saving and loan crisis, the invasion of Iraq, and the total cost of NASA, including the moon landings, all added together and adjusted for inflation, Blankley is unrepentant. We were wrong about a lot of things, but don't forget about all we got right. We helped people to borrow more money than anyone ever thought possible. And with that borrowed money, they went out and bought their dreams. Yes, they fell far, but only because they had soared so high. Higher than the human race had ever gone before. High enough almost to touch the face of God.
One thing's for certain,
Jürgen says, putting down the magazine.
The days of thinking inside the box are over.
He sounds like a nutter, Ish says.
They are not paying him to be sane,
Jürgen says.
They are paying him to innovate solutions and then monetize them.
He sounds like my Uncle Nick, Ish says.
Excuse me,
Jürgen says,
but having heard several stories about your Uncle Nick, I am satisfied that he and Porter Blankley bear no resemblance to each other.
Have I told you about the time he bought a bag of ferrets? Ish says.
Doesn't sound like he's a big fan of lady bosses,
Jocelyn Lockhart says.
Bet Rachel's shitting it.
You'd better watch your back too, Ish, Gary McCrum advises.
I wonder if he'll send us an inspirational memo,
Kevin says.
It's so exciting.
Paul hasn't arrived yet, but I set the Blankley article aside for him. That's not the only thing awaiting his attention this Monday morning. Jürgen plays a song for us on his phone, which he tells us he recorded with his old reggae band, Gerhardt and the Mergers.
As the lyrics are in German, I will give you a synopsis. This song is called Banking Babylon. It tells the story of a Rastafarian who comes to the big city in order to look for a loan. However, the bank manager, who is white, turns down his application.
Why, he says. He's a racist.
At first, it appears a straightforward case of racism. However, as the song goes on, we discover that there is more to it than meets the eye. The bank manager has legitimate concerns about the Rastafarian's ability to repay the loan. Specifically, he believes the Rasta wants to use the money to buy ganja and not a startup capital for a small business as he is claiming on his application form. So, you see, it is overturning your preconceived notions.
Ish and I agree that this is a very unusual angle.
That was the unique selling point of our band, the Mergers,
Jürgen says.
As four white men working in highly paid private sector jobs, we were able to give both sides of the story. This is evident in the very title of the song. In Rastafarianism, Babylon, which according to the Bible has enslaved the Jews for many centuries, is regarded as the site of all evil. But in fact, ancient Babylonian society was highly sophisticated. Indeed, with the Hammurabi Code, the Babylonians could be regarded as the forefathers of modern banking. That is something few reggae songs give credit for.
Ish, for her part, has bought in some anthropological material about the island of Torobundo. Turns out to be pretty interesting, she says. So the Polynesians have been there for thousands of years, just minding their own business, canoeing back and forth between the other islands in the archipelago. Then in the 17th century, the British arrive and start raiding the islands and carrying people off to use as slaves. The building that eventually became Bank of Torobundo, that was the headquarters of the whole operation.
It was quite common for empires to station their slave trade in the New World, Jürgen says. As it was no longer tolerated in Europe, it became a sort of offshore industry.
Could be pretty good for the book, though, eh? Ish says. Like this big fancy bank's origins are sending slaves off to dig up pigeon shit.
Scratch beneath the surface of any great power and you will find slavery,
Jürgen says equanimously.
The Romans, Alexander the Great, this very city in Viking times was the biggest slave market in Europe. In fact, Irish slave girls became units of currency for a time.
They used girls as money, Ish said, horrified.
Ireland did not have any precious materials, gold, silver, for export,
Jürgen says.
So for international trade, they used to use slave girls, or kumals. I believe one kumal was worth approximately 3 cows.
That explains a lot about Irish men, Ish says, looking darkly at Jocelyn Lockhart, who's taking a call on the other side of the cubicle. A lot.
My point is that slavery has always been a part of the business world, Jürgen says. But what is to be gained by dwelling on the past or unpleasant aspects of the present? Most people would prefer to think about happy, upbeat things that reflect our 21st century outlook, such as smartphones or casual sex with attractive strangers.
Yes, but Paul wants to show what's beneath all that, Ish says. Such as slaves.
Jürgen taps his pen against his teeth. I do not think it will be necessary to bring this particular detail to Paul's attention.
Ish squints at him. You're not censoring me.
Of course not. I am simply advising you as your superior that this is not the kind of information the average Joe Bloggs reader is interested in. I know because I have asked myself, as the average reader, if I am interested in reading about the bank's origins in slavery, and the answer I have come back with is a resounding no.
He issues a decalorized smile.
Now, time to work, Claude. Please review this report for Mellon. The statistical information seems underdeveloped.
He tosses a heavy folder onto my desk. I wait till he's gone, then hand it to Ish, who hands it to Kevin. Put in more pictures, she tells him.
7 o'clock becomes 8, becomes 9, with no sign of Paul. I try to work, but find it hard to concentrate. In fact, I have been fretting all weekend. What did he mean when he said he wasn't getting to the heart of things? The bank's whole purpose is to get away from the heart of things, to turn things into numbers, then those numbers into imaginary things, then to divide up the imaginary things into pieces to be bought or sold, swapped or hedged back and forth again and again, until the underlying reality they emerge from is entirely forgotten. He knows that. It's what drew him to the subject in the first place. So what's the real issue? If he thinks something's missing, does he mean me? His eventual appearance, shortly before 11, does nothing to reassure me. He is pale, tired, preoccupied. I give him the Forbes article, but he puts it aside with barely a glance.
Something is bothering you.
There is no sense ignoring it.
It's just a little more complicated than I expected, he says.
His smile, meant to put me at ease, only flags his own frustration.
What can I do?
I offer to make him a flowchart showing the different departments at their various tasks. I ask if he wants to go over the analyst's assessment methods again, price, earnings, ratios, free cash flow, and so on.
No, he shakes his head. It's not that.
So what is it? I ask with my heart in my mouth.
It's the money,
he says at last.
The money?
If it's a book about banking, ultimately it has to be about money, right? But I don't...
He trails off, knits his brows.
I don't see anything. You do all these deals, you get paid all these fees, and it's all just...
He makes a poof gesture with his hands.
I say. Maybe you need to visit the back office.
Back office?
The administrative part of the bank, it's where they do the paperwork, record into the system all of the trades, underwritings, bond issues, and so on, put the actual money into the accounts.
This seems to awaken his interest.
How come I haven't heard of it till now?
There is a Chinese wall between it and the rest of the bank. Seeing his blank look, I clarify, that just means that access is barred to us, in case someone is tempted to sneak in during the night and change the records, cover up a bad trade or losing ticket, even reroute funds into an unauthorized account.
Right,
Paul says, frowning again and opening his red notebook to jot this down.
So you can't go in there?
From our side, no, the doors are locked, but I'm sure you can get clearance if you are looking around only for your book.
He asks me if I will make the arrangements. This turns out to be difficult, and not just for reasons of security. There is a strict hierarchy to investment banking. of which back office lies at the very bottom, below even lawyers. Suspecting accurately that the analysts and traders look down on them, just as the M&A bankers look down on us, back office are notoriously unsympathetic to requests for help. My banking career started in the back office, however, and this gives me a certain amount of currency among them. Eventually, Paul gets his tour. When he returns, however, his mood seems even worse. He takes out his notebook and sits by the window, but he writes nothing, instead just stares balefully out over the river. Then, though it's not even 4 p.m., he gets up and leaves. He doesn't say goodbye.